In our study tonight, we're talking again about the book of Nehemiah. I want you to look, if you would please, at Nehemiah chapter 1. Nehemiah chapter 1. Real quick review of some of the things that we've talked about in Nehemiah chapter 1. We learn who Nehemiah is and what his responsibility is. In Nehemiah chapter 1, he's made inquiry regarding the condition of the city of Jerusalem. And he's learned that the walls are in ruins, the gates are still in a state of, charred, burned, disrepair?
They were a mess.
Yeah. And so Nehemiah prayed unto God to remember the people of God and remember the things that he had promised them as they obeyed him. They would return, they would once again be blessed. The latter part of chapter 1, the last portion of it, identifies the prayer of Nehemiah that he might have or find mercy before this man. And we know from the next verse that he, or next portion of the verse, that he was cupbearer to King Artaxerxes. And then he came in to serve King Artaxerxes, and he was not very happy, obviously. The king said, "Your countenance is sad. What's wrong?" And again, we see that Nehemiah prayed. And the king asked what he could do. And Nehemiah told him that he would like leave to go and rebuild the walls around the city. Yes, David?
Cupbearer, does that mean that he's tasting wine stuff and see if they're poisonous or not?
Well, I don't know. My understanding of that was he just was the man responsible for bringing the cup to serve Nehemiah. I mean, serve the king. That was his role, which brought him in close daily contact with the king, but nonetheless, he was still a servant. And so that's all I know about what a cupbearer does. He bears the cup to the king. And what it had in it, I have no idea. What we see here is it was a position of prominence that brought him into the presence of the king. And that in itself gave him opportunity to ask a favor of the king to take leave and be gone and to go and rebuild the walls. Now that's the essence of Nehemiah chapter 2. The latter part of it, we know that there were enemies who did not want to see the walls progress. The enemies wanted to see them lie in ruins. And Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem, the Arabian, are identified at the last part of verse 2. We note that Nehemiah begins to divide up in chapter 3 the work of rebuilding among the families of the people of Israel. And they began to build. In the fourth chapter, we saw how that Sanballat, when he heard that they were rebuilding, began to make fun of them. And then in verse 3, Tobiah said that even if a fox go upon your stone wall, he shall break it down. So we see ridicule and making fun of them. And we see in verse 6 a very important text. So we built the wall, and all the wall was joined together unto half the height thereof, for the people had a mind to work. We don't want to forget that, because the walls have laid in ruins for how long?
16 years.
They came back and they began to build the foundation of the temple. And then the temple was completed, and now the walls still lie in ruins. So that needs to be completed. And when we read further in chapter 5, we see that there's one thing that became a problem. The people were willing to work rebuilding the walls and fight the enemy with their sword in one hand and build the walls with the other, latter part of chapter 4. But what brought the work to a cease or a halt? Chapter 5.
Taxes and borrowing, and they were.
Well, they were, and they were mortgaging their children for the money, and when they could not pay, the folks who had loaned the money took their children. And so they were charging great interest and so forth. And Nehemiah simply points out to them that this is wrong and made them promise not to do that anymore. And he became an example of charity or an example of benevolence, I should say, in the latter part of chapter 5. Now, in chapter 6, you might label that chapter as an effort to compromise on behalf of the enemy. We see that four times Sanballat called upon Nehemiah to come down to the plains of Ono. And then the fifth time, we find that Nehemiah answered essentially the same, "I'm not going to go." And then in verse 10 and following, we read of Shemaiah that called upon Nehemiah to come to the temple, and "We'll close the door of the temple because your life is being threatened, and I'll protect you." No. We find in that same chapter that verse 12, Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. In verse 15, the walls were finished in 52 days. In the seventh chapter, the work of registering the people. And we won't read all of that, but I simply want to call your attention to it, to know that here we read of the list of those who return from Babylonian captivity. In the eighth chapter, we read of the beginning of the reading of the law. And when the book of the law was opened and Ezra began to read, what did the people do? They stood up, indicating reverence for the law of God. They stood up from early morning until midday, and the Levites and a host of folks began to speak distinctly to the people, giving the meaning of what had been read. And then in the ninth chapter, generally we have an honest heart when we learn through the reading of the Scriptures that what we're doing is not right. What effect should it have upon us? Alright, it should prick our hearts or cause us to change our minds, as it were, about the way that we're living. And so it did the people. They began to cry and confess their sins because their sins were great. In the ninth chapter, in verses 1 through 4, once again, we see evidence of that. Beginning in verse 7 of chapter 9, another passage that I believe is worth underscoring in your mind. And that is, the land that God had promised unto Abraham is here again identified. And God has been, according to Nehemiah, faithful in giving Abraham and the descendants of Abraham the land that he had promised in verses 7 and 8. And you'll note there the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanite, the Amorite, the Hittite, and the Perizzite, and so forth, precisely as you read in Genesis chapter 18, I believe it is, beginning about verse 15. Or maybe I have that turned around. Genesis 15, verse 18, I believe it is. But as you continue reading in the ninth chapter, we see numerous evidences of the rebellion of these people. Beginning there in verse 25, again in verse 26, or beginning at verse 26, again in verse 27, and then in verse 28, the period of the judges, and then in verse 29, once again, they've not kept the ordinances of God. In the latter part of verse 30, they would not give ear, wouldn't listen. And then in verse 33, Nehemiah reminds the people, or reminds God rather, "Howbeit thou art just in all that has come upon us, for thou hast dealt truly, but we have done wickedly." Now, in the latter part of verse 9, it says in verse 38, "And yet for all this, we made a sure covenant and write it, and our princes, our Levites, and our priests seal unto it." Now, when they write down a covenant and all these high-class fellows seal it, what is that? What have they just done?
They made a contract.
They made a promise, a solemn promise. Here's what we're going to do. Well, what is it that they're going to do? Look, if you will, at verse 22. Verse 22 of chapter 10. It says, "They cleaved to their brethren, their nobles, and entered into a curse and into an oath to walk in God's law, which was given by Moses, the servant of God, and to observe and do all the commandments of Jehovah our God, and His ordinances and His statutes, and that we would not give our daughters unto the peoples of the land, nor take their daughters for our sons. And if the people of the land bring wares or any grain on the Sabbath day to sell, that we would not buy them on the Sabbath or on a holy day, and that we would forego the seventh year and the exaction of every debt. Now, they've made a promise in this that's threefold. Will not intermarry with the people. Chapter 10, verse 30 and 31. I'm just kind of reviewing, getting up to chapter 11 and 12 and 13.
You cited verse 22,
though. Did I cite verse 22? Sorry about that. It's verses 30 and 31. Chapter 10, verses 30 and 31. Yeah, I can see the confusion. Verse 22 just tells you some names. That won't work.
Were you going to read that?
I'm going to read now in verse. No, I'm not going to read all those names. He's picking on me, isn't he? So they make a threefold promise. What was it? Will not intermarry with the heathen nations. Number two. All right, we're going to be faithful in the observance of the Sabbath day. And the seventh year. The exaction of every debt, we're not going to do that. We're going to forego that. Now that they have promised to do, and the reason I want to call that to your attention is we're going to revisit those verses just a little bit farther down the pike when we get over to about chapter 13. Now in chapter 11, we talked about how that the city of Jerusalem was going to be populated now that the temple is rebuilt, the walls around the city have been completed, the gates have been set up. Who's going to live inside the walls and who's going to live outside the walls? How did they determine that? They cast lots. That's right. They cast lots. And I want to get past this. There we go. They cast lots. That's the 11th chapter for the most part. Now you will notice in the 12th chapter, it is a great day. A grand occasion for the people of Jerusalem. In verse 27, let's pick up the reading. And who would like to read some for me? 27 through 30. Randy, please.
Nehemiah 12, 27 through 30. Now at the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, they sought out the Levites from all their places to bring them to Jerusalem so that they might celebrate the dedication with gladness, with hymns of thanksgiving and with songs to the accompaniment of cymbals, harps, and lyres. So the sons of singers were assembled from the district around Jerusalem and from all the villages of the Tapphites, and Beth Gilgal and their fields in Geba and Asmaveth, where the singers had built themselves villages around Jerusalem. The priests and the Levites purified themselves. They also purified the people, the gates, and the wall.
Sounds wonderful, doesn't it? It's a great day. The dedication of the walls around the city. If this book just ended right there, we could say that Nehemiah did a lot of great things and the people assisted him in doing a lot of great things and everything's good. But it doesn't end there. Notice again, Randy, while you're reading of this great rejoicing, verse 43.
And on that day they offered great sacrifices and rejoiced because God had given them great joy. Even the women and children rejoiced, so that the joy of Jerusalem was heard from afar.
Now that sounds wonderful, doesn't it? But then we've got chapter 13. You've heard the expression, when the cat's away, the mice will play, right? You remember back over in chapter 1, Nehemiah was asked by the king, or I should say chapter 2, he was asked by the king, what can I do to help? And what did Nehemiah request?
Send me.
All right. Now, the king and the queen asked Nehemiah a question. You remember what it was? How long are you going to be? So he assigned them a time.
12 years.
12 years. And told them, that's how long I'll be gone. So, yeah, turn that off, please.
I got to find it first.
Well, it's in there. If you have a little device like this, you might want to turn it off.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you.
Sorry, that happened. Normally I make sure that's off. Nehemiah has assigned to the king a certain time frame when he will come back. Now, in chapter 13, if you'll look at verse 4, Randy, while you're reading so well for me, would you read 4 through 6, please?
Nehemiah 13, 4 through 6. Now, prior to this, Eliashib the priest, who was appointed over the chambers of the house of our God, being related to Tobiah, had prepared a large room for him where formerly they put the grain offerings, frankincense, the utensils, and the tithes of grain, wine, and oil prescribed for Levites, singers, and gatekeepers, and the contribution to the priests. But during all this time I was not in Jerusalem, but in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I had gone to the king. After some time, however, I asked leave from the king.
All right. His time has expired. He goes back to renew his leave. What's happened while he is away?
The enemies are put in the temple.
Tobiah is given quarters in the temple by Elisha the high priest. And I think that's just absolutely fascinating. What was the high priest's responsibility? Well, what was the priest's responsibility, generally?
Teach,
make the offering. Yes, educate the people, read the law, etc., etc. But here we see that the high priest has become an ally to Tobiah, the enemy, and given him quarters in the temple where the grain and the goods for the priest was supposed to be stored up. Now, what does that mean that the priest have to do? If the grain and the goods that are prepared for them are no longer there, what do they have to do?
Go outside and get them.
That's right. Now, if you look at verse 10, Randy, and read for me, please, verses 10 and 11.
I also discovered the proportions of the Levites had not been given to them, so that the Levites and the singers who performed the service had gone away, each to his own field. So I reprimanded the officials and said, "Why is the house of God forsaken?" Then I gathered them together and restored them to their posts.
A lot to do, isn't there? The priest had gone to the field to have the sustenance of life that was to be provided by the people stored in the temple. And now we find that Tobiah is living in that portion of the temple. And what did Nehemiah do when he found that Tobiah was living in the temple?
Booted
him out. Yes, verse 8. I cast him forth and all of his household stuff out of the chamber. And he had to set things in order with the priest, make sure that they were back at their appointed task, doing their job. Furthermore, again, while you're reading, Randy, would you pick it up at verse 15 for me and read through verse 17, please?
13:15-17. In those days I saw in Judah some who were treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in sacks of grain and loading them on donkeys, as well as wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of loaves. Brought them into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. So I admonished them on the day that they sold food. Also, men of Tyre were living there who imported fish and all kinds of merchandise and sold them to the sons of Judah on the Sabbath, even in Jerusalem. Then I reprimanded the nobles of Judah and said to them, "Why is this evil thing? What is this evil thing you're doing by profaning the Sabbath day?"
What are they doing?
Profaning the Sabbath day.
Well, yes, but specifically. What they just promised. Go back to chapter 10. And you'll notice there in verses 30 and 31 that you read a moment ago. This is one of the three items that they have promised. They've entered into a covenant. We will not do this. And here they are doing the very thing they promised they would never do again. Now, Randy, while you're doing such a good job reading, would you pick up read for me verse 23 through verse 25, please.
Before I do, how long was he gone? How long was he back in the valley?
Richard said that he'd taken leave for 12 years, and I'm guessing you get that.
The other way. That's how long he was away from Babylon.
Oh, away from Babylon.
Yeah, how
okay.
long did he go, was he gone into Babylon?
I don't know that we know that.
American Santos says certain days.
Yeah.
Pretty much like yours.
I don't know that we can.
Could we possibly infer that it wasn't a period of years?
I would assume it to be a short time because what his work was to go back and renew his leave.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We might assume it to be a short time. But a lot of things have happened during this time. And it doesn't always take a long time. You remember that Moses was upon the mountain receiving the law for 40 days, and the people went all the way from worshiping God to calling upon Aaron to build us a calf. And they called that God.
A little over a month.
Yeah, 40 days, a little over a month. So it doesn't take a long time for people to swing the pendulum to the extreme. But when you notice in verse 23 through verse 25, what are they doing now?
Now they're mixing marriages.
They are indeed, yes.
I would see right, it wasn't the over period.
Okay.
You still want me to read?
Yes, I do. Please read that.
23 to 25. In those days I also saw that the Jews had married women from Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. As for their children, half spoke in the language of Ashdod, and none of them was able to speak the language of Judah, but the language of his own people. So I contended with them and cursed them and struck some of them and pulled out their hair and made them swear by God, you shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons or for yourselves.
All right, let's pause right there. Now, in reference to your question, how long was Nehemiah gone? I really don't know. It indicates that they had married these women and have children by them, and they can't speak the Hebrew tongue. Now, whether these women had children when they married them or not, I don't know. So, to be definite on how long Nehemiah was gone, we might look at this and say, well, he's gone a long time, a matter of years. I don't know that. I don't know that. It wasn't uncommon when they're intermarrying or marry somebody with children. So, I don't know. But what we do learn is they had mixed marriage. What was one of the things in chapter 10 they promised they would never do? That specifically. Now, as we read in the book of Ezra, in chapter 9, chapter 10, Ezra rebuked them because of their intermarriage with the heathen nations. And in chapter 10, what must they do to correct that? Put them away and their children. Now, you think that wouldn't be difficult for them? To have children old enough to speak another language, not to know the Hebrew tongue, but to speak the language of Ashdod. Evidently, they've had these women for some time. And I find that to be quite interesting in view of the promise they just made, that we won't ever do that. Now, one other thought I want you to see in that is how Nehemiah responded to it. What did he do in verse 25?
Cursed them, struck them, and pulled out their hair.
Cursed them, struck them, and pulled out their hair. How did Ezra respond to it? Pulled out his own hair and sat down confounded, perplexed, just didn't know what else to do. And Nehemiah, as we've described him as a man of action, he rebukes these people and makes them, as it were, get rid of these foreign women that they married. Now, look at verse 26. He said, did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations there was no king like him, and he was beloved of his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, even him did foreign women cause to sin. Shall we then hearken unto you to do all this great evil, to trespass against our God in marrying foreign women? Of all people to cite in their history, one of the greatest kings they'd ever had. And we know that the kings were not to multiply wives, going back to Deuteronomy chapter 17. But how many wives did Solomon have?
A lot.
700 wives and 300 concubines. Now, we need to count that he lived in a time when sometimes it was a political maneuver to marry the daughter of the king of this land or so forth. He had a lot. He had multiplied wives.
That's got to be more than all the countries.
Well, perhaps, but what we want to know, is that they corrupted Solomon. Solomon wound up worshiping idols for a time in his life and built some of these temples for his wives and their idols. Now, they're rebuked here in this passage, but if you look at the latter part of this chapter, chapter 13, verse 28 began. Randy, would you read for me once again verses 28 and 29?
You're still in the last chapter?
Yes, please.
28 through 29?
Yes.
Even one of the sons of Jehoiada, the son of Elisha, the high priest, was the son-in-law of Sanballat the Horonite, so I drove him away from me. Remember them, O my God, because they had defiled the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites.
All right, now tell me again who Elisha is.
High priest.
But let's go back specifically. What did he do? Look at chapter 13.
He set up a place for Sanballat right there.
All right.
Tobiah.
He's become friends with Tobiah. And we see here that his son has married the daughter of Sanballat, the Horonite. Now, does that surprise you? You know, we might talk here for just a moment about evil companions corrupting good morals. Look at what his daddy did. So it ought not surprise us extensively that this is what his son did in marrying the daughter of the enemy of the people, and Nehemiah chased him from him. Now, one other point I want us to see just here. In verse 29 and also in verse 31, we learn that Nehemiah called upon God to remember me, O God, for good. Now, we've seen that a number of times. Look, if you will, in the 13th chapter, just backing up a bit to verse 22. It says, "And I commanded the Levites that they should purify themselves and that they should come and keep the gates to sanctify the Sabbath day. Remember unto me, O my God, this also, and spare me according to the greatness of thy loving kindness." Backing up to verse 11. "Remember me, O my God, concerning this, and wipe not out my good deeds that I have done for the house of my God and for the observances thereof." Chapter 13, verse 14. Now, what is it that Nehemiah is calling upon God to do? Remember. Now, the thing I want you to remember is that Nehemiah calls upon God to remember him for the good that he did in rebuking these people for the evil things that they did. Nehemiah didn't do it. He's being faithful to God. He's carrying out the responsibilities that have been enjoined upon him. Now, as we look back at the context of some of these books that we have studied, Nehemiah, Ezra, and Malachi, we've not spent a great deal of time in Zechariah, but what we do know is that God promised prosperity if what? You keep my commandments. The blessings were conditioned upon keeping my commandments. Now, does Nehemiah know why Israel was not being blessed? When he goes back and reviews their history, he says, "Here's what you've done. Here's what historically you have done." And then he told them, "God has kept his promises, but you've not kept yours." When we studied about the book of Malachi, and we noted that in the sermons past several Sunday nights, as we've talked about that book, we've noted that Malachi is constructed where a statement is made, and then a question is asked by the people, and then the answer is given. And we talked about that in the sermon material. But what do we know about Nehemiah's indictment of these people? Did he know why they were not being blessed? You remember in Malachi chapter 1, Malachi reminds them that you work and you don't have anything. You put your money in a bag, but it's as if it has holes in it. And what's the point? You're not prospering because you're not doing the things that God has required of you. You're not keeping His commandments, His statutes, and His ordinances. You see, it was not God's fault that Israel was not being blessed. They had forsaken God. And Malachi knew that. When you turn back to the book of Haggai, Haggai describes a circumstance in the rebuilding of the temple. Did he know why Israel was not being blessed? Sure he did. He called upon them to consider your ways. What were they doing? Haggai chapter 1. They were building their own sealed houses, living in nice, luxurious, comfortable places. And what kind of condition had they left the house of God in? In ruins. So they had forsaken God. They'd made many wrong decisions. Now granted, when they came back, they met with some opposition after the foundation was laid. But now there's not a whole lot of opposition. 16 years down the pike and they're still not building. So we got a problem. Now, one other thing that I want you to notice, Ezra. We've read rather extensively in Ezra. But I want to call your attention to this text, Ezra chapter 9, verses 6 through verse 15. Now, you can read it off the chart, or you can read it out of your Bible, but I'm going to read it, and I want you to listen carefully. Ezra said, "Oh my God, I am too ashamed and humiliated to lift up my face to you, my God, for our iniquities have risen higher than our heads, and our guilt has grown up to the heavens." Does Ezra know why God hasn't blessed them? Well, absolutely. Continue reading. He says, "Since the days of our fathers, to this day we have been very guilty, and for our iniquities we, our kings, and our priests have been delivered into the hand of the kings of the lands, to the sword, to captivity, to plunder, and to humiliation, as it is this day, and now for a little while. Grace has been shown from the Lord our God to leave us a remnant to escape and to give us, that's surely not right, a peg in his holy place." A place, I think that should be, in his holy place.
You
got a peg in what translation are you reading from?
New American Standard.
Okay. Give us a peg in his holy place. Okay. "That our God may enlighten our eyes and give us a measure of revival in our bondage. And now, O our God, what shall we say after this?" And then he concludes, "For we have forsaken your commandments, which you commanded by your servants, the prophets. And after all that has come upon us for our evil deeds and for our great guilt, since you, our God, have punished us less than our iniquities deserve, and have given us such deliverance as this, should we again break your commandments?" Now what's Ezra saying they've done over and over and over and over? They've forsaken God. They've broken the commandments. And the consequences of their sin has brought them into captivity. They've been punished, but they've not been punished sufficiently, even according to Ezra, for the violations that they have committed. Any questions or comments just here? Well, I didn't read all of that. It says, "Would you not be angry with us until you had consumed us so that there would be no remnant or survivor? O Lord God of Israel, you are righteous, for we are left as a remnant, as it is this day. Here we are before you in our guilt, though no one can stand before you because of this." God is righteous. He always does what he says he will do. He never fails. But the people had failed, and they had failed repeatedly. And so consequently, God's wrath had been turned upon them. Now, I want to pass from these charts. Do you have any question or comments just here? Yes.
That passage you just read, evidently he was weeping and praying aloud. That's, chapter 10 begins with, while he was praying and making confession, weeping and frustrating himself in the house of God, a very large assembly of men, women, and children gathered to him from Israel, for people wept bitterly. So apparently, they were empathizing with it, what
yes.
he was saying.
Yes.
Realizing what he was saying was true.
Yes.
And realizing that they were in a really horrible condition before God.
Yes. They themselves had acknowledged their sin, the intermarriage with the heathen women and so forth. We talked about this.
The fact that Ezra, beyond simply the words, he got them to do something about it. I mean, he got them to act, and he challenged them to do what they needed to do. More than just getting angry about it, he challenged their will, and they responded.
Well, that's right. More on that in just a moment. Yes, David?
I like the prophets. Word of shepherd comes to mind because of Moses. He would have been a shepherd, the land of Midian, I believe. And so who would think the shepherd would go back to Egypt? But as you think about a shepherd, it's one that continuously watches over the sheep, watches for the jackals or the wolves or whatever. So it's actually a pretty hard job. So the shepherd is watching over his people. And the religious is watching over his people all the time.
Well, that's right. And, of course, these men that we've been talking about, they were not only prophets, which served as a mouthpiece for God, but they became great leaders of the people of God. And, Chris, to your point, to motivate them to do something. I think that's something we need to be impressed with, because that's often very, very difficult. Haggai motivated the people to build the temple. Between Ezra and Nehemiah, they were motivated to, Nehemiah in particular, to rebuild the walls, and did so in a short time. And that's not always an easy task. You know, when we think about these men, I guess one of the things that I want us to see as well is the power of God's Word. In each of these instances, in Nehemiah chapter 8, as well as what we read in the book of Ezra, the law was read, and the law of God impacted these people's hearts and pricked their heart and caused them to correct some things. They themselves were moved in Ezra chapter 9 and so forth to tears because of the sins they had committed. I think sometimes that arrogancy or pride gets in our way, and if we're ever to do what's right, humility has to be involved with that. Any other questions or comments? Yes, Bruce?
You know, when you go back and look in the New Testament where Stephen, you know, basically, you know, told them all the things that they had done, but then they acted totally different because they stoned him.
Yeah, they stoned him to death rather than to be pricked in their hearts like those of Acts chapter 2 and asked, what shall we do?
But they were pricked, but they were pricked.
Yeah, they got mad.
Yeah.
There was another mission along the way, the greater purpose that God has made to Abraham through the seed of Abraham.
Well, that's right. And of course, you have this remnant. There must be said about the remnant. There's always been a small group of God's people that were faithful to Him. When we think of the remnant, we can look at these men. They had been returned from the captivity, which indicates that during the period of the captivity, here were men that feared God. And they were trying to do what was right. And they've been returned now to urge these people to do what's right.
So God was faithful from the day of creation.
Well, He'd never been unfaithful. No. And sometimes we need to be reminded of that. Yes. Any other comment or question? All right, I've got some questions. When we look at lesson number 35 in your lesson book, you should have these. And if you don't, I have some more. They've been passed out. Questions on lesson 35. Anyone need one? Linda? Yes, ma'am. Anyone else? Lesson 35. Questions? Okay. Now, being as you have these all done in advance, this should be a quick review, right? All right, number one, the permission granted by Cyrus would be able to return home included all the tribes of whom? The Israelites, that's right. Number two, most of the northern tribes, Israel, were scattered throughout what empire? All right, the Assyrian Empire, the northern tribes, when the city of Samaria was conquered in about 722 B.C. When Samaria fell, the capital now of the northern 10 tribes was taken away. The southern tribes, Judah, were scattered where?
Babylon.
That's right. And, of course, this had been prophesied long before it came to pass that they would be taken into captivity. Number four, at the time that the Israelites were allowed to return to their homeland, Persia controlled all the territories that once were held by what two empires?
Assyria.
All right, the Assyrian and the Babylonian, yes. And then number five, since it had been nearly 200 years since the first captives were taken from Israel, many of the Israelites chose to do what? Stay right there. That's right. stay where they were. They'd become prosperous and so forth where they were, and they didn't want to leave. Number six, approximately 50,000 Jews gathered in what city to begin their journey back home?
Babylon?
Well, yeah, that'd be it. They gathered in Babylon. Number seven, who was named the primary leader of the return?
Zerubbabel.
Yes. Number eight, when the Jews returned to Jerusalem, many valuable vessels were brought back that were taken from the temple and palace by whom? Nebuchadnezzar. Yes. King of the Babylonians. Number nine, the Jews had been away from their land for at least 50 years. As a result, who had grown in power in the Palestine area?
Everybody.
Yeah, that's right. The Samaritans had. They had expanded their borders, and of course they were not very conducive to the Israelites returning. They asked, as you recall, to assist in the rebuilding of the temple, and they were told no. Tell me who the Samaritan people were. How did they originate?
Scattered. That's what the Assyrians did with their conquered peoples. They scattered them all over the place and took the Jews, scattered them around, took some other people from other places and scattered them into what was Israel.
Yes.
And they intermarried and with mixed race people.
All right, that's where it originated. Now, the text you may want to remember on that is 2 Kings 17. 2 Kings 17.
And Samaria was the capital.
Yes, it was.
The Northern
Territory. Yes, that's right. All right. So the Samaritans had expanded. Much of the fertile land was now being inhabited by whom? Yes, the Ammonites. Very good. The Edomites and the nomadic tribes, the Arabs, as you see on this map. So when you look at each of these, you see that they've grown in their territory that they now possess. And so the Israelites coming back are really not all that welcomed. And it's going to be difficult for them to reestablish themselves in the land. Number 11. In the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, three returns are described. What was the first return?
Zerubbabel.
All right. Jews returning under the leadership of Zerubbabel to build the temple. What was the second return? Ezra, that's right. He came and brought back the priest, read the law, restored the reforms that needed to be restored. Number 13, the third return.
Nehemiah and the
wall. All right, brought back Nehemiah and the rebuilding of the walls. Very good. Number 14, when the work of rebuilding the temple under the guidance of Zerubbabel began, many of the Jews were saddened because they remembered what? They remembered its former glory. That's right. They remembered what it was, the splendor of the temple that Solomon had built and that Nebuchadnezzar had burned. Number 15, while the Israelites were building the temple, adversaries took steps to try to get the work to stop. As a result, the work did stop for approximately how many years? 16 years, yes. The text you may want to remember to do those calculations are from Ezra chapter 4. Cambyses, and by the way, tell me who Cambyses was. He was called by another name in our text.
Artaxerxes,
yes. Now, again, in reference to Cambyses or Artaxerxes, there was a title that was given to him. What was he also called?
Ahasuerus,
yes. Now again, to further note who he was, what relation did Artaxerxes have, or Ahasuerus, as he was called, or Cambyses, to Cyrus? I believe it was his grandfather. His grandfather. So what we want to note here is that Cambyses was a descendant of Cyrus, ruling now over the Persian Empire. That accounts for us the time element.
It's got confusion.
Ancestor.
Yeah, Nancy.
Who was the older?
Cyrus.
Cyrus came first.
Yes.
So Cambyses was a descendant?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, grandson, I believe.
Okay.
There was an Artaxerxes the first, and then an Artaxerxes the second. This is Artaxerxes the second, the grandson of Cyrus. But when he became the ruler, he continued to push the borders of his kingdom outward. He succeeded in taking Egypt and ending the reign of who? The pharaohs. Yes, exactly. When Cambyses died, who became king of Persia? All right, Darius the Great. When Darius came to power, who urged the people to resume the word? Well, that would be
Haggai
and Zechariah. Yes. All right, number 19. The temple was finished 20 years after the work began. Therefore, it really took only how many years of labor to build the temple? Now, you mathematicians in the family, you can do the math on that.
4 years.
Yeah.
Well, it says
I had to throw that in.
I didn't put the scripture reference down there, but it says in the scriptures it took 4 years.
Okay. Yeah, you can do it. Either way, just do the math. Ezra chapter 4, you can do it that way as well. Number 20. I didn't put the scripture down either, Richard, and I probably need to do that. I can't remember offhand where it is. Number 20. What story takes place between chapters 6 and 7 of the book of Ezra? The story of Esther. Yes, the story of Esther. Esther became the queen to what king? All right. Xerxes. Now this is Artaxerxes' son.
Yeah,
I
believe that's right.
Yeah. I get confused on those, the first and the second, so forth. But yes.
He's also called the Ahasuerus.
Yes, a title.
Two other kings were called.
Yeah. That was a title, much like calling the Egyptian kings Pharaoh. Yes, very good. Number 22, what was the name of Esther's uncle who was raised to a highly responsible position in the kingdom? Mordecai. Yes, very good. Number 23, in the 7 years of Artaxerxes, the son of Xerxes, he granted permission for whom to go to Jerusalem? Ezra. Over 2,000 people returned to Palestine with Ezra. Most of these people were the priests and the Levites. Okay. Well, we'll have to stop there. Number 25.